Well, the Australian Prime Minister has called an election. That means that the chattering classes have begun oh so a chattering. And my profession, which I really don't consider to be my profession, because it brings such shame on itself, my profession of journalism has done its darndest to dishonour itself, discredit itself, and generally muddy the waters of voter information barely a few days into this election campaign. In Australia, if you're wondering, outside of Australia, the Prime Minister has the right to call an election in a particular window of time, thereby trying to pick a date that is most advantageous to him or her. Don't know why we still do it that way. Many states, including my state, has abolished that and replaced it with a fixed term, as they have in the United States, which makes more sense. But both political parties stand more to gain from retaining the ability to call an election when they are in power than they stand to lose by having their adversaries call an election when they're out of power. So the silly process continues. Nonetheless, we've been waiting with bated breath for the Prime Minister to call it, and it has been called. You may recall that some weeks ago I expressed my frustration at the predictable gotcha question that many journalists ask of politicians, which goes along the lines of how much is a loaf of bread or how much is a liter of milk. I know my American listeners would not know what a liter of milk is, so you can replace that with a pint, which you probably also don't know because imperial measurements make no sense. But putting that aside, I railed against a journalist who asked that of the Prime Minister some weeks ago. And in recent days, the news cycle has been dominated by breathless column inches and bloviating from radio and television hacks about the fact that the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, made a gaffe, when he was asked what the unemployment rate is and what the Federal Reserve Bank's baseline interest rate is. And he took a guess at the unemployment rate. He thought it might be 5.4%. Turns out it's 4%. He yielded to his advisor or a minister who was next to him. I don't recall who that was, but obviously one of the people who we employ as taxpayers to make sure that the Prime Minister is given the information when he needs it so he doesn't have to retain stupid factoids in his head. And she got it correct. And he has spent the past 2, 3, 4 days embroiled in endless questions about why he didn't know what the precise unemployment rate was and how he could possibly feel for unemployed Australians and the hardship that good Aussie battlers are enduring in this economy of ours if he wasn't able to cite to the precise decimal point what the unemployment figure is. This has just continued and continued, and today it reached its zenith, its apogee, or perhaps I should say the depths of tawdriness that I've come to expect from much of the media. As an aside, the headlines in the press are just so silly as to write their own jokes. The Greens leader, Adam Bandt, the leader of the Green Party, he proposed that dental care should be free under Australia's Medicare for All universal public health system, under which dental is not currently covered. So how did the nation's main broadsheet newspaper, owned by Rupert Murdoch, his first and most prized possession as a media mogul, report on Adam Bandt wanting to include dental in Medicare? Their headline reads, Election 2022, quote, I'll tax the rich to pay for your teeth, end quote, says Adam Bandt. I'll tax the rich to pay for your teeth. To which one culture critic on Twitter, Patrick Lenton, tweeted, did a pirate sing this? I'll tax the rich to pay for your teeth. Arr! Which I thought was rather good. But sad that he has such easy fodder to stoop to make a joke like that. So what happened today was that that Greens leader was giving a speech at the National Press Club and taking questions from journalists. And some pipsqueak who I didn't know until now, I have the misfortune of knowing him, who happens to be, I think, the economics editor of probably the most prestigious newspaper in Australia, the Australian Financial Review, read by the financial titans and in the corridors of power in the capital. He thought it would be an opportune time to ask a question of Adam Bandt and to append to it a gotcha question in the same vein as how much does milk cost, how much does bread cost, what exactly is the unemployment rate. But this time he asked what the wages price index is. This is an arcane measure of wage inflation. And he thought, I initially, when I heard this, I thought he was joking. I thought he was sending up his type of journalist. But it seems he wasn't. He got on Twitter and he tweeted, "Not reading Twitter for 24 hours for obvious reasons, but my wife tells me some of you think I look youthful. You're too kind. Also, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but if you make a claim about poor wages, you should probably know the key measure of wages." Shrug emoji. "Anyway, see you on the flip side." Greg Jericho, another journalist, a financial journalist, tweeted, "I spend most of my days writing on wages and labour markets, and I don't remember what the wages price index currently is. Good thing I have access to the internet, which enables me to check in about 5 seconds. Crisis averted." He says, "I would also need to check the average interest rate. I would also need to check the underemployment rate. Guess my articles are all worthless now." And he adds, "If journalists think memory is important, maybe they should all take down the printouts of the cabinet and shadow cabinets that most of them have next to their desks, because surely they can remember all of them, given they write about politics." And he says, "I thought we all realized rote learning was stupid and pointless for demonstrating intelligence in about 1995. Apparently not. But what gave me heart in all of this, as my profession sullied itself so poorly with these stupid gotcha questions that don't tell us anything about anything, apart from whether or not a politician has been craven enough to memorize as many things as they possibly can. What did happen, the silver lining in all this, was Adam Bandt's response to this guy. It wasn't aggressive. He didn't put him down overtly. But have a listen to a couple of minutes of this exchange.
Talking of abject fact-checking exercises, you said in the speech that wages growth wasn't going particularly well. What's the current WPI?
Well, Google it, mate. I mean, like, I am sick. If you want to know, if you want to know why people are turning off politics, it's because what happens when you have an election that increasingly becomes this basic fact-checking exercise between a government that deserves to be turfed out and an opposition that's got no vision. This is what happens. Like, elections should be about a contest of ideas. Politics should be about reaching for the stars and offering a better society. And instead, there's these questions that are asked about, can you tell us this particular stat or can you tell us that particular stat? And those questions are designed to show that politicians are somehow out of touch and not representative of everyday people. Well, newsflash, most of the people in Canberra are on six-figure salaries just passing time until they go out and work for their coal and gas corporations and get a six- or seven-figure lobbying job. Do you know what would be a better way of showing? Do you know what would be a better way of showing that politicians are in touch with the need of everyday peoples? It would be passing laws that lift the minimum wage. It would be making dental and mental into Medicare. It would be making sure that we wipe student debt and build affordable houses. And when you've got wages growing at about 2% and inflation growing at about 3.5%, that is part of the problem. And I would hope that at this election, we can lift the standard and turn it into a genuine contest of ideas.
Your profit tax.
There you have it. Adam Bandt, the leader of the Green Party in Australia, responding to a question from the Australian Financial Review about whether he had memorised an arcane data figure and the insinuation that he didn't know anything about cost of living pressures if he couldn't recite the precise number. That heartened me. And again, this is not a party political thing. I'm no rusted-on supporter of the Greens. I was critical of the journalist who asked a gotcha of Scott Morrison, a Liberal. I was critical of the journalist who asked the gotcha of Anthony Albanese, a Labour member. This kind of thing has to stop. These questions are not uncomfortable questions. They're not uncomfortable conversations. They're nothing that I seek to be associated with or I seek to champion. They don't tell us anything. I mean, part of the point of my championing of uncomfortable conversations is not just that the actual dialogue is uncomfortable. As you will note if you're a regular listener, these conversations are not always uncomfortable between me and the guest. They're usually quite amicable. The point is that we're having conversations about things that are uncomfortable, about things that most people feel awkward about transgressing, about things that people feel are uncomfortable, about things that most people feel awkward about addressing bluntly and frankly and with no holds barred, no consideration of whether or not it's going to transgress a tripwire that has been erected by their tribe or some other. And these kinds of gotcha questions do none of that. They don't actually hammer down into the things that matter. All they do is try to embarrass a politician temporarily and dominate the news cycle, and idiots in the rest of the media then feed off that and keep asking questions like they have of the opposition leader relentlessly for the past few days, such that he has to contort himself into an apology for something that he shouldn't really apologize for. That's what I found refreshing about Adam Bandt's response, the refusal to apologize, the refusal to dignify the whole framing of the question with any credibility. There have been some rays of light. Tom Ballard, a comedian who I know and respect and like, tweeted, "If I were running for public office, I would simply know all the answers to all the questions. Then everybody would like me and I would win." Exactly. Is that the implication? Daniel Bleakley, a climate activist, said, "How can Scott Morrison be taken seriously when he doesn't even know the current atmospheric carbon dioxide parts per million figure?" And Cameron Williams, a tech journalist, tweeted, "Do journos who ask gotcha questions realize they are tanking their own profession, which needs less tanking right now? I am a journo. I speak truth to power and ask tough questions, like what is the price of a Paddle Pop ice cream?" Exactly. How fatuous. Now more than ever, we need journalists who don't collaborate in a kabuki dance with politicians. We need journalists who ask questions and have conversations that are difficult, that push boundaries, that think big, that think beyond the everyday, that talk on the kind of terrain that at least Adam Bandt had the guts to open up. We need journalists and politicians to have conversations that stretch us and that are sometimes, yes, a little uncomfortable. Today on the show, cast your mind back to mid-January of 2020. Oh, such innocent times. Oh, such sweet little babes. We were blundering forwards into a world that we thought would resemble the world of the past, not knowing that it would become quickly upended completely. At that time, there were news reports about this Wuhan flu, and it was the same as the news reports that we'd heard about the swine flu and about the Ebola outbreak in Africa and about the SARS and the this and the that. There was a lot of sort of eye rolling of like, oh, we're going to have another big one coming, are we? And even people like myself who I think back about the early days of the pandemic and remember there being weeks that felt like decades in which I was screaming from the rooftops that this was going to be something that was going to change the world, and people thinking that I was being hysterical. I was at the supermarket buying a lot of canned goods before, you know, while it was still crazy preppers, crazy gum-toting preppers who were doing the same, not the regular housewives scrambling around that would come 2 or 3 weeks later. And yet even I, in around the time of mid-January, was still just looking, you know, with sort of calmness and a slightly perplexed attitude at what was going on in Wuhan, thinking it probably wasn't going to derange the entire planet as it has.
One person who was not in such a mindset, one person whose job it is to raise the alarm about such things and who sure did so, is Eric Feigelding, who is an epidemiologist who penned a now famous, now notorious, at the time extremely controversial, subsequently less so because he was so prescient, tweet thread. He only had about 2,000 Twitter followers. Despite his pedigree, he had set up a Facebook page which had 5 million followers, which was about cancer prevention. It was a campaign for cancer prevention. He had run for Congress in the 20-teens. He's a Harvard-educated epidemiologist and nutritionist. And he saw the R-naught of this Wuhan coronavirus, and he was looking at his data, and he tweeted, now famously, all caps, "Holy Mother of God." This was on January 20th, I believe. I'll read the whole tweet thread, just so you can get a sense, and try to read it through the perspective of, a jaded and complacent globe. We were all focused on Donald Trump, and we were focused on the 2020 election, and we were focused on basically the fact that these sorts of viral pandemic scares crop up every so often and go nowhere. And he wrote, "Holy Mother of God, the new coronavirus is a 3.8, meaning the R naught is a 3.8, meaning that the average person is going to infect 3.8 other people going about their normal daily lives in the absence of social distancing, masks, hand washing, sanitizing, vaccination, and all of that. Remember, there was none of that back then. He wrote, "How bad is that reproductive R-naught value? It is thermonuclear pandemic level bad. Never seen an actual virality coefficient outside of Twitter in my entire career. I'm not exaggerating. Hashtag Wuhan coronavirus, hashtag coronavirus outbreak." He went on to tweet, "We estimate the basic reproduction number of the infection to be 3.8. indicating that 72 to 75% of transmissions must be prevented by control measures for infections to stop increasing. We estimate that only 5.1% of infections in Wuhan are identified, and by the 21st of January, a total of 11,341 people had been infected in Wuhan since the start of the year. Should the epidemic continue unabated in Wuhan, we predict the epidemic in Wuhan will be substantially larger by the 4th of February, 191,529 infections. Infection will be established in other Chinese cities, and importations to other countries will be more frequent. Our model suggests that travel restrictions from and to Wuhan City are unlikely to be effective in halting transmission across China. With a 99% effective reduction in travel, the size of the epidemic outside of Wuhan may only be reduced by 24.9% on the 4th of February. Our findings are critically dependent on the assumptions underpinning our model and the timing and reporting of confirmed cases, and there's considerable uncertainty associated with the outbreak at this early stage. With these caveats in mind, our work suggests that a basic reproductive number for this 2019 nCoV outbreak is higher compared to other emergent coronaviruses, suggesting that containment or control of this pathogen may be substantially more difficult. Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Hashtag Wuhan virus, hashtag coronavirus outbreak, hashtag China coronavirus." Summary, he writes. "So what does this mean for the world? Question mark, question mark, question mark. We are now faced with the most virulent virus epidemic the world has ever seen. An R-naught of 3.8 means that if it exceeds SARS's modest 0.49 viral attack rate, by 7.75 times, almost eightfold, a virus that spreads eight times faster than SARS cannot be stopped by containment alone. A 99% quarantine lockdown containment of Wuhan will not even reduce the epidemic spread by even one third in the next 2 weeks. Thus, I really hate to be the epidemiologist who has to admit this, but we are potentially faced with possibly an unchecked pandemic that the world has not seen since the 1918 Spanish influenza. Let's hope it doesn't reach that level, but we now live in the modern world with faster planes and travel than 19. At WHO and at CDC.gov needs to declare public health emergency ASAP! Exclamation mark. At the time, he seemed deranged. At the time, even his colleagues, even other people at Harvard, said, you've got to delete this. This is scaremongering. This is ridiculous. The World Health Organization came out and said there is no evidence of human-to-human transmission yet. Everyone in Wuhan might just be getting this from, you know, gobbling up bats or whatever. Feigelding disagreed. He continued to shout from the rooftops. He was cowed into deleting that Twitter thread. It took me a long time to find it in an archive. It's not on his Twitter thread anymore. And so began this roller coaster that we've all been on. In March of 2020, late March, and cast your mind back to that. Can you remember what that was like? The whole world basically locked down. New York City, a sort of remote hellscape where no one was out and about except for ambulance sirens tearing up and down the streets and huge refrigerated trucks outside hospitals to capture the overflow of bodies that had to be taken to the morgue. Hospitals completely overwhelmed, northern Italy. Just devastated. And the whole world, essentially in lockdown. At that time, David Wallace Wells, the journalist for New York Magazine, wrote a profile about Eric Feigelding, pointing out that if people had listened to him 2 months earlier, the world would be in a very different state because we didn't really start doing anything for the subsequent 6 weeks, 7 weeks, in some places 8 weeks after that Twitter thread. And that was enough time for the virus to run completely unchecked and become seeded and in all sorts of cities all over the world and to explode. David Wallace Wells, in his piece, said that if Feigelding's warning had been widely published, then the high death tolls in Italy, Spain, and Iran, which were three of the countries that were hit hardest by COVID-19 in the early months, could have been avoided. A quote from David Wallace Wells' piece, if Eric Feigelding or anyone with his level of alarm had been running pandemic response in any of those countries on January 20th, talking about Italy, Spain, and Iran, every single one of them would be today immeasurably better off, having initiated at the very least the same social distancing approaches, testing protocols, and personal protective equipment and ventilatory production we are now hoping for and scrambling to produce. We got caught with our pants down at the beginning of this pandemic. We didn't have enough of anything. We didn't have enough masks, nurses and doctors without protective equipment. No clue. No preparedness, really. And that was largely because we were coasting along, not listening to people like Eric Feigelding. I thought it would be interesting to hear his recollections about that experience, his interpretation of how the pandemic has unfolded, and his predictions about what the next phase of what he, as a lone voice in the woods, initially called a thermonuclear pandemic. I hope you enjoy this fairly wonky pandemic conversation with the Chicken Little who was screaming from the rooftops before anyone else was, the Harvard scientist Eric Feigelding. Go back to the beginning of the pandemic, because it's a funny trajectory that you've taken of having 2,000 Twitter followers before COVID and now having nearly 700,000 Twitter followers. What are your recollections of January of 2020 and how the sort of metaphorical alarms started flashing in your head?
I think, you know, we're in year three of the pandemic, and January of 2020 is one of those... You know, I had a sinking feeling in my stomach the whole time. And I have relatives in China, and I have lots of colleagues who are, you know, well-known epidemiologists who have lots of ties in China. And, you know, in many ways, you know, China is a very controlled media environment, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that the Chinese government didn't even really know what to censor on the internet, it was quite a wild west. That showed that this was something that's definitely beyond their control, that's something that they don't have a handle of. And I think that was, in many ways, a signal, in addition to all the anecdotes. Because all we had in early January were anecdotes after anecdotes. And
from Wuhan?
From Wuhan. I think I'm a big firm believer of precautionary principle due to some things in my early childhood, you know, surviving a large tumor. We don't have to get into that, but I think it's just one of those things where I've seen this before. I've done whistleblowing, you know, kind of like early warning things, whether it's the Vioxx drug, dangerous drug many years ago, whether I was concerned about Flint, lead poisoning, whether it's Theranos, you know. Many years ago, I was working on a labs startup, and I knew there was something wrong with it, and that Theranos was very suspect. So I, you know, I had that same sinking feeling, and each of those times I didn't blow the whistle early enough. And so this is like the fourth time I've had it in my life, and I knew that this was going to be bad, and all the data was, anecdotal data was really bad. But, you know, as a scientist, the problem is you're not supposed to make any declarations until you know for sure, right? And this is where, in certain ways, I had beef with the WHO early on. Remember in mid-January, there is no evidence of human-to-human transmission. Well, it's not that there's no evidence. There's no proof there is, but there's no more proof that there isn't either. Right.
The absence course, of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
Exactly. And of course, you know, I think that was a very big faux pas on their part. And they didn't declare the public health emergency of international concern in the first time they met in, I think it was on the 20th or something, 21st. And I was extremely upset about that. And so, you know, I, in many ways, I've put my time in academia, Harvard, for 16 years. It's not where I want to be forever. And I didn't have a scientific career to protect, right? I wasn't gunning for promotion. So I said, you know what? I'm going to call a spade because all the data is lining up, and the early preprints, which today we rely on preprints all the time. But back then, oh, how dare you cite a preprint that's not peer reviewed? God forbid. But, you know, year three in the pandemic, preprints are everything. But back then, it's like, oh, it wasn't peer reviewed. But all the data was lining up. It's like a confluence of data. It was lining up. And in many ways, it's kind of like sometimes how detectives work. Detectives rarely get a smoking gun fingerprint DNA match on camera with a retinal eye scan, right? But they piece it up that the circumstantial evidence plus all the other evidence, if they all line up together in a way that's like very concerning, I think
why were you an outlier, Eric? Because there were, at this time, mid-January, there were a lot of people still cracking jokes about the Wuhan virus. Right. I was at a party. I remember when it was, because it was around Australia Day, which is the 26th of January. And someone said, oh, you should try the Wuhan chicken off the buffet. You know, this was a punchline. You know, there's this thing going on overseas, and it's kind of quirky. Yeah. And that was a few weeks before even I, as a bit of a data wonk, started, the hairs on the back of my neck hadn't quite started raising yet, and I was early. Yeah. But you know, the question is, yes, the WHO may have been too cautious in the way that it was communicating with the public by saying, well, there's no evidence of this, there's no evidence of human-to-human transmission, even as people like you were saying, well, of course there's human-to-human transmission. It's a respiratory pathogen.
It wasn't just that. There was also asymptomatic transmission. You know, remember early on, you don't need to wear a mask until you have symptoms.
Yeah, right? But and we can get into, in a sec, I want to get into all of the confused, you know, contradictory messaging, which I think has fueled part of the skepticism in many parts of the population towards official claims about the pandemic. But just on this question of alarmism versus sort of slow walking the alarm bell ringing, there was a sense before the pandemic that the media always goes crazy about these stupid, you know, bugs somewhere in the Middle East or China. I remember Bill Maher doing jokes about, here's the latest bullshit that we're, you know, that they're getting us all hysterical about during MERS or, you know, whatever it was. Right. You know, every time, you know, it's we're all going to die of Ebola. We're all going to die of Middle Eastern respiratory. We're all going to die of SARS. It never bloody happens. You know, there's a swine flu. There's a Zika. You know, basically, the media has been crying wolf on this sort of thing for a long time.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, a stopped clock is right twice a day. If you're constitutionally hardwired to see alarm everywhere, maybe you just sort of got lucky by, you know, maybe you're a Chicken Little who just happened to sort of get lucky.
I think it's there's a lot of other situational things. You know, first of all, my first doctorate at Harvard was in epidemiology, so this was in my wheelhouse. You know, a lot of people say I'm a nutritionist. I'm also a nutrition scientist. That's my second doctorate. But I think as an epidemiologist, you know, you have to look at the tea leaves of data. And I used to teach meta-analysis. I've taught meta-analysis and research synthesis and systematic review at Harvard for over like 13 years, 14 years. And when you do that, you always kind of piece together early data. And the piecing together early data is like the hardest thing because, you know, with the Merck's drug Vioxx, which is a $1 billion drug, the early data was really a trickle, right? It was really like if you coin flip, it's kind of like if you coin flip something, you should see an even distribution of heads or tails. But if you coin flip like 10, 15 times and you're getting like 13, 14 heads, right? You know, it's like it's not definitive proof, but you know statistically the odds of that coin flipping always on one side is very low and very unlikely to have just happened by chance. And I think that instinct comes from many years of doing epidemiology, big data analysis, doing systematic reviews, teaching people how to do systematic reviews and how to find early signals, especially when it comes to drug safety. And I think it's just there's an intuitive instinct of when the data becomes uncanny, and I think
was the data in January of 2020 in addition to the anecdotal reports out of Wuhan was the point the reproductive rate the
yeah it was the R naught at first that was like the first definitive thing because I couldn't you know. Anecdotal stuff like VAERS stuff is anecdotal. Like you can't always go on anecdotal, but if you get anecdotal stuff from many different independent sources and they all kind of like confirm the same directionality that this is a really bad signal. And if you know China and if you know how people in China tick and people, you know, people in China, my relatives and my Chinese colleagues, they know when something is government propaganda. They don't say it, but they know. But whenever they see something happening on, you know, WeChat, their Weibo and social networks, and it's popping up in a very unusual way, and there's no censors that's systematically clamping down, it's real, right? Those kind of signals, like most American scientists and don't have because they don't have their ear to the ground there. And they don't, not everyone's trained in epidemiology, nor in the signal filtering from you get from meta-analysis research. And then, of course, you know, I've had many years of, you know, looking at data. Like, for example, our Vioxx meta-analysis, we poured through like over 1,000 papers and over 200 trials, trial reports. And so, you know, we've poured through all these data before. So this is one of those things that, you know, I think there's many other people who were concerned. I'm not the only one who was concerned back then. But I think it's the, if a butterfly flaps its wings, but no one was there to hear it, or if you don't make it loud enough, you know, did it really happen? And I think the other aspect of the fact that we're talking about this is that a lot of people heard what I said because many years ago, I also, in another life, you know, built a big social network on Facebook. I have a 5 million person Facebook page that I own that I rarely use, and I don't usually declare a publisher every, you know, broadcast or leverage it. And even for this, you know, in the Holy Mother of God tweet in January, I never actually used it back then. Because I know what kind of like messages help reach the masses. And I think Twitter was a better platform than Facebook because, you know, journalists, members of Congress, Parliament, they're on Twitter, but they're not on Facebook. And what I wanted to reach is a lot of the journalists and get the media to wake up, not just the lay public. So I know, and you know, I've had a small 1,000, 2,000 person following for 10, 12 years on Twitter. It never bothered me that, you know, you know, it's, I've never
Twitter been is not your path to world domination, Eric.
It was not. There are other avenues. It did not make, I was not self-actualized or defined by my Twitter.
I've got news for you, mate. Nobody is self-actualized on Twitter. Twitter is not the... If you go onto Twitter for your spiritual fulfillment, you're looking in the wrong place. But let's get to what you alluded to earlier on the WHO's advice about both skepticism towards your alarmism and then skepticism about the utility of masks from the CDC and so on. I think that began the ball rolling. The initial claim that masks weren't going to be useful and then that flipping into a claim that masks were essential undermined the people's perception of the credibility of authorities. And now I find myself in a position where I'm constantly trying to argue for the stupidity and incompetence of institutions as the better option against the malfeasance and evil and like conspiratorial desire to control us all interpretation of some other people and alternative media.
I'm definitely not a conspiracy theorist. And I think a lot of there's bad actors out there. You know, I think there's a spectrum. There is, you know, honest, innocent, skeptical people because they don't know how science works. They don't know how science gets updated. They don't know how we're learning as we go. And if we change something, it's not like government trying to exert more control and dominance. It's just, oops, they made a mistake. Now, as a scientist, there are scientists who have been shouting about airborne, shouting about you need masks early on, shouting about air symptomatic transmission, human-to-human transmission, reinfection and all that. And then shouting at those other scientists who keep saying, nah, that's overblown. No, that's not true. There's no asymptomatic transmission. The you don't need masks until you have symptoms was these stupid scientists who basically say, prove to me definitively without a shred of doubt left that, you know, that there's asymptomatic transmission. Whenever there's a lot of anecdotal, a lot of early, you know, preliminary studies, small studies that show there's asymptomatic. There's some hard ass scientists who basically says, you know, unless you basically show me definitive ironclad proof, it's not real. And in a pandemic, though, that kind of attitude is very dangerous. And this is why I think Mike Ryan is right. He's a director of emergency programs at WHO, that, you know, being perfect is the enemy of good here. And if you want to wait until you're absolutely certain and before you act, you're going to lose against the pandemic. And there's those people who basically were denying airborne and all these other things because they didn't have show me a randomized controlled trial, blah, 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 that this is completely true with 10,000 people. No, that's not like that. Vaccines, we do that. And vaccines, we heavily test. But with a lot of these airborne asymptomatic stuff, you know, we just have to like go with the flow and said the anecdotes and all the evidence shows that this is likely real. And we have to take precautions. But they did not. And I think they have blood on their hands. Those who denied airborne, denied asymptomatic, denied reinfection. But I think this is why, you know, obviously people who attack each other on different sides of the spectrum, people kind of like, yeah, okay, that's politics. But when people see scientists attacking each other, I think that's actually more dangerous. Because when scientists attack each other, then they're like, oh, I'm throwing my hand up in the air. Scientists, they can't even figure it out. So I think those denialist scientists actually do more damage because they undermine the credibility of and undermine the precautionary message. And of course, they downplay everything, and downplaying COVID is what part of what got us here.
So when you say that, you know, some of these people have blood on their hands for shaming people like you as having been alarmists and for not being sufficiently clear-headed in their public communications, the counterpoint to that is that there will be a lot of reckoning for people who advocated aggressive policies that ended up doing nothing as well. And, you know, one of the things that I try to impress upon people who think that Australia has become a totalitarian fascist dictatorship is that by closing the borders for almost 2 years and launching large contact tracing systems and comprehensive sort of isolation requirements, it's certainly in New South Wales, the most populated state, not speaking to Victoria, which relied much more heavily on questionable lockdowns and curfews and things that were much more brutalizing to the population. But where the majority of Australians lived, the outdoor recreation was never really curbed. There was a brief period during the Delta wave when there were some strict requirements for certain suburbs, but in general, my experience of the pandemic was an experience of spending a lot of time at the beach with my toddlers, hunting for crabs and walking around, and you weren't allowed to lie down and sunbathe with friends and contaminate each other, but you were allowed to get out and about. In contrast to places like California, where I saw images of bulldozers, you know, bulldozing sand over skate parks so that teenagers couldn't skate, like with no one thinking, well, what are the teenagers going to do if they're not skating outdoors? Are they just going to like stand under a tree 6 feet away from each other, or are they going to go inside and smoke dope? And play video games. Yeah. You know, those kinds of things are, I think, what planted the seed, along with the flip-flopping and equivocation around masks, the disingenuousness of claiming that masks were not useful when, in fact, the reason for not recommending masks was because they were useful and they didn't want to rush on masks. Like, all those early days, that kind of chaotic messaging and the seemingly arbitrary overreach, to me, sowed the seeds for what we're now reaping, which is a deluge of bullshit that people are more liable to believe because their trust in institutions has been corroded. If you wind the clock back to January 2020, how do you avoid that?
Well, how do I avoid that is, first of all, you know, don't tell people it's just a flu whenever it's not. You know, there's clowns. Don't tell people you don't need a mask when you clearly the evidence says you should. But you should also clarify that outdoor is much better than indoor because the nature of, you know, indoor air being stagnant. But I think this trust of government leaders, oftentimes government leaders, let's just be honest, every government sometimes elects a bad leader, and bad leaders sometimes have bad advisors, right? You can elect a good leader but have bad advisors. And some of these bad advisors just happens to be some of the airborne deniers, you know? Some governments have really good airborne precautions. Some governments never did contact tracing, you know, and I think this is human nature. We sometimes elect bad political leaders. Sometimes they appoint bad scientific advisors, and that, you know, this is where they don't take, you know, oftentimes, you know, even with Joe Rogan, I don't actually blame him that much. I think it's just his circles. Sometimes you sail in if you're a cruise ship and you sail in the Arctic waters, you're going to see lots of whales and icebergs. But if your cruise ship sails in Caribbean tropical waters, you're going to see a lot of beaches and palm trees. But if that's all you ever sailed, you always think that the world is full of beaches and palm trees. Mm. And I think this is where governments need to really have a better scientific advisory system that listens to different scientists telling them, hey, you guys are wrong about this. You know, stop listening to them. There's all this other evidence that says there's breakthrough infections. There's all this evidence that you need to wear masks and better masks. We need better advisors about, you know, all these other precautions. And this is how you can combine things. Oftentimes, it's a haphazard situation of who has the policy leader's ear and who has, you know, Joe Rogan's ear. Oftentimes, you know, if you're surrounded by yes people or obviously politically motivated people, they're not going to give you the best advice. Or people with a certain, you know, ideology, they're going to give you info from their little corners of the world. The world is full of beaches and palm trees. While someone else, if you actually sample the world, will say, no, the world is also full of whales and icebergs and mountains as well. And I think that is oftentimes this who has the political leader's ear is just as important as who we elect. And unfortunately, sometimes we have really bad scientific advisors and just unprecautionary advisors or just tone deaf advisors and who are just completely behind the science, don't follow the literature, you know, dismiss any signs of warning. And basically it's like everything's fine while their house is burning around them, just like that meme.
The question that it raises for me then is, let's ignore for a moment official advice and now talk about advice that, quote unquote, advice that people are getting from social media and podcasts, and why it is that there is this kind of self-selecting ecosystem of people who increasingly are only seeing polar bears or are only seeing palm trees. Like, I mean, I have my theories about this kind of siloing of information and the capture and audience capture and so on. But it's really hard to tell a person who only ever sees polar bears that the world isn't full of polar bears, and they just think that you're being disingenuous, that you're obfuscating, that, you know, how do you grant them that, yes, polar bears do exist? You know, some people get myocarditis after getting the vaccine. Some masks aren't very effective. Some public policy recommendations have been wrong or flawed or even, you know, willfully, even lies. But in the aggregate, that doesn't mean that we're all living in the Arctic.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, people who go out to party and they're healthy, they rarely see anybody really sick. And if they are sick, they're home. And if they're out of sight, out of mind, and it's not real. And people rarely, most people rarely ever visit an emergency room, or they actually, you know, everyone sees that it's snowing outside, or everyone can see there's a traffic on this highway, right? But people can't see that there's a crazy traffic jam in the ER. They can't see that there is, like, we're out of ICU beds, you know, we have body bags. All those things are hidden from the public. And even someone who's, like, really sick and has a, you know, 40 degree centigrade fever, they're home cooped away and no one really sees it. Because again, this is a selection bias. If you're at a restaurant or if you're at a nightclub, you're probably pretty healthy, or and you're not seeing anyone sick around you, right? That's how the world is. I think there's people need to be shaken that, you know, there are people who are sick. They're incredibly sick. They're overloading hospitals. Those things you cannot deny. And those things should be blasted to people's psyche that, you know, just like, oh, it's a little warm today. It's going to rain. Oh, today hospital beds are 95% full. You should not be taking risk. And if you have a heart attack, because no one says that I'm never going to have a heart attack. If you have a heart attack, if you have a car crash, because plenty of people speed on the highway or, you know, drive dangerously and live dangerously. If you have any of these car accidents, guess what? That 95% of the hospital beds being full is really relevant to you, even if you don't think you're going to get COVID. Mm. I think people need to see it. People, if you don't see it, they don't believe it. Oftentimes, people in the South didn't believe that there was a true COVID emergency in New York City when hundreds and thousands of people were dying in New York City because no one around them had COVID. It didn't hit their part of the country yet. And I think also, of course, media siloing. It's incredibly dangerous. Obviously, you know, the Rupert Murdoch stations of the world, I don't think I need to say which ones, and obviously even more right-wing shows, and oftentimes many TV streaming shows are even more polarized. It creates this, you know, an echo chamber of, oh, vaccines don't work. Vaccines are dangerous. Vaccines is tyranny. Whenever, you know, on the other side is, you know, vaccines is about caring about others around you. Vaccines do work against hospitalizations. They do lower the risk of infection by a lot. And they are safe. They are safer than COVID infection. You know, your immune system is not perfect. You know, all these things, if there was a central conversation that you could crosstalk like this, if like the Joe Rogan audiences and Fox News audiences listen to the MSNBC and CNN audiences and the mainstream CDC believing audiences, and they just like had a conversation and we hashed out this issue like earlier about this, you know, this prevention being lowering your probability of disease by 50%. That's prevention. It's not negation, right? But it's prevention. Then we could have had like eliminated half this conversation about masks don't work or vaccine don't work, like instantly.
Eric, doesn't it cut both ways in the sense that, you know, I do feel that there's been a lot of finger wagging dismissiveness of people raising legitimate questions about particular policies. So, you know, there'll be certain jurisdictions, I believe still in Victoria, the Premier, you know, the second most populated state in Australia, the Premier has said that unvaccinated people are not going to be able to work at all outside the house until the end of, you know, until 2023 or something. And I've gotten emails from people who work in construction in regional Victoria who spend the entire day by themselves on a tractor in the middle of nowhere who are not allowed to do that because they're not vaccinated. And then someone will say, you know, what real threat are they imposing on the rest of society when we're dealing with a variant, Omicron, that is incredibly contagious, even among vaccinated people. And yes, it might be slightly more contagious if you're unvaccinated, and maybe that person is imposing an additional burden on the health, on the public health system, but so are very fat people and so are smokers, and, you know, and on and on and on. And to respond to those criticisms by saying you're an anti-vaxxer has, I think, contributed to part of the inability for all of us to get on the same page about this.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think sometimes policies are too blanket across the board. You know, if you're a lifeguard on a beach, you know, your risk is pretty low, right? Because you're outside, you're in the sun. And I think that's just poor, sloppy policymaking. But I think if you're a restaurant worker, that's really dangerous. And there's a reason, you know, many Western countries have banned smoking in restaurants, because your right to smoke ends at my nose. But if I'm a restaurant worker or a flight attendant and I don't have that choice, then your smoking on an airplane or smoking in a restaurant endangers my health, and therefore we should ban smoking. I think this endangerment of others, like, for example, if you eat bacon, it's your own darn choice that you do to yourself, right? But it rarely, other than, you know, setting bad example for your kid, it rarely, you know, spreads to others per se. Although I think social network effects are also really important for, like, smoking and alcohol. But I think we should have this, you know, better calibration. You know, everything should be better calibrated. But then, you know, obviously some say, oh, I don't want big government calibrating everything, you know. But I think you should take the minimum precautions in certain places. Like, if you don't have this, then at least have ventilation, or work, you know, if you're working alone and you're not working indoors, then it's not and you're not in a consumer public facing situation such as restaurants and hospitals, then, you know, you can have more relaxed guidelines. I think there should be more of this mix and match, just like we mix and match different vaccines, we mix and match different mitigations. We should have, well, at least do, if you don't vaccinate, at least test daily, at least wear a mask then, or at least if you're working indoors, or at least ventilate your building to ensure it has, you know, 6 air exchanges per hour, or install a HEPA filter that can, have cleaned this room several times an hour as well, 6 air exchanges an hour. Like, if you have all these things together, then, you know, like, okay, fine. If I have all this, you know, air ventilation or air disinfection installed, then I don't need to. I think in certain ways that could be a good compromise. And that way we don't have to fight as crazily as we do about vaccines. I still think we need vaccines, because boosters really keep people out of the hospital, so that whenever you have a heart attack, you make sure you get your heart attack treatment, and your grandmother has her stroke treatment can be treated. I think all of these things should be mixed together, and we should have at least a combination of things. But there is this care for the others, right? There, you know, we pay taxes and we have programs to help the poor, to help the hungry, to feed the children, clothe the children. You know, even though they're not our kids, we're still paying taxes for it, because there is this betterment of society thing. And I think the other argument, people saying, like, look, the longer the COVID goes on, the longer this is horrible for all of us. So if you want to shorten it, then let's work together. But this solidarity thing, you know, we've lost it in our society, our hyper individualistic society. You know, a lot of Rogan's audience are libertarian. You know, sometimes, you know, I'm a big Elon Musk fan. You know, I've said it on record. I'm not a fan of everything he does, but I'm a big Elon Musk fan. And, you know, sometimes that's why I listen to Rogan sometimes as well. But I think there's the libertarian aspect of a lot of this liberty for absolute liberty's sake and everything else be damned. How dare I pay? The really poisonous Ayn Rand attitudes of, like, why should I pay for other people's children? Why should I feed other people? They can starve to death. They can die of malnutrition. It's not my damn problem. I think that's really hurtful in society.
I would also pick up on the point that you just made about, like, the longer this goes on, the worse it is for everybody. Because even I think you can even get the hardcore Ayn Rand libertarian to concede that having flights constantly cancelled because pilots are sick and having schools constantly disrupted because teachers are, you know, are sick or are close contacts and having, you know, not being able to go to the movie theater. It's just really annoying. And one of the misconceptions about countries that have been more aggressive about suppressing the spread is that things have been sort of more disrupted and life has been more, has been less like the pre-pandemic era than in places that just got on with it and let it rip. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, you know, I constantly hear from people in Western Australia, which is still zero COVID, which is still closed off even from the rest of Australia. I cannot go from Sydney to Perth still. But the reality is people there are pretty bloody happy. The majority of people are like, I don't want to have lockdowns. I don't want to have to wear masks. I don't want to have to socially distance. We're all, you know, we've all been eating in our restaurants right up close to each other and not caring about the pandemic at all, completely untouched by all of the things that are screwing up life for everybody else all over the place. Even just set aside your care for other people, set aside the health risk, set aside the deaths and hospitalizations, set aside the sense of community. Just from a personally self-interested point of view, it's actually just better to live in an environment in which there is not a rampaging pathogen disrupting your life.
Having certainty, having regularity is what people are seeking, right? Like people, you know, people are okay adapting to change in some ways. Like, for example, if we're more ventilation, HEPA filters, you know, I think people are not going to complain. Or, you know, we have all this airport security, you know, that we did not have before 9/11. Airport security is annoying. They patch you down, grope you, but, you know, people are living with it because, you know, it's something that allows them to live, you know, relatively normal and secure again. Look, I think I believe in, you know, the common good and all these things. And by, you know, I also, you know, when I, in my teenage years, I had a libertarian streak and tendency, and I see what they mean. And I think freedom, of course, but I also have a different version of freedom. Like, for example, why should I pay government taxes for healthcare? Well, you know, you have then you have the freedom to quit your job, especially in America. You have freedom to still ensure your child gets cancer and diabetes, insulin, and drugs, even if you quit your job. I think this freedom from COVID is something that is not been discussed enough. The freedom from COVID is freedom from most of the mitigations that we can return to normal. But the freedom from COVID requires an act of short-term pain for long-term gain. And those who do not want to pay that, you know, care for our fellow man, our community, our kids, our parents, grandparents, because they're just, you know, poisonously, you know, Ayn Rand libertarian, I think it's dangerous. You know, I think some freedom, libertarian tendencies are often good, but people need to see that the common good is also can be their good, especially when something is like a pandemic. And that's why I want both sides to come together. You know, Joe Rogan has a big platform. I think he needs to, you know, offer the other side more and not just have the ears of some of his viewers who only give him one side of something. And I think this could be true for many sides of the media.
I want to get to this question of Rogan and like who counts as an expert and so on. But just to pick up on what you just said about, like, you know, we have to be willing to endure some short-term pain for long-term gain. That sort of invites Keynes's classic quip about, you know, in the long run, we're all dead. So how long is the short-term pain that we need to put up with? And when does the long-term gain pay off?
Yeah, I think it's sooner. I think, you know, by the way, in the long run, we're all dead. There's a joke in epidemiology. I can prove that smoking doesn't cause mortality by making everyone smoke and then follow them for 200 years. But at the end of the day, everyone's dead, just like everyone who didn't smoke. Right. But the matter is like when, right? When it matters, not just the outcome, but when does the desired outcome, you know, living longer or not dying, when does that happen? You know, when does the pandemic end? You know, in the long run, everyone's dead. Yes, but you want quality of life. And in public health, there's not just life years, but there's, you know, quality life years, disability adjusted, disability free life years. And those, you know, right now in the pandemic, we have based everyone has a societal disability because of this damn pandemic. When are we going to free ourselves from this so we can have disability free life years or relatively healthy life years? It's again, it's not just the length of life, it's the depth of life, right? Mm. And that, my friends, I tell them, you know, your freedom and liberty by fighting for this collectively. And this is something that requires everyone to collectively do, not on an individualistic basis, collectively do as a society, we can end it earlier. And can you, you know, that collective sacrifice, you know, defending your country, and, you know, taking the hit, you know, I just think of sometimes in, you know, when the Fukushima nuclear disaster happened, and a lot of people had to go into the radioactive zones, and it's either going to kill them or make them sterile, right? A lot of the elderly volunteered to do it instead of the 30-year-olds and 40-year-old fathers who have children. And they said, you know, I've lived a good life, but I want my grandchildren to have their fathers. So I'm going to go into nuclear reactor. Mm. And that kind of sacrifice is, you know, the elderly 60-year-old may not be living that much longer, but he made a sacrifice so that the rest of society can live better. And I think that kind of sacrifice, and we're not asking you to walk into a nuclear reactor, right?
We should clarify that.
We're just asking you to wear a damn mask. And I think, you know, it's just so sad. Like, look, we want to get out of this sooner. Freedom, the freedom from mask, is to collectively work together. And I think this is why this ultra-libertarianism is a little dangerous. But if they see the long term, again, it's kind of like quarterly earnings. Stop focusing just on the quarterly earnings and trying to gain, you know, the stock buybacks to just juice your short-term profits.
Right.
Focus on the long-term health of your country, your society. And if you just do that, have the long-term goals in mind of everyone, then the stock market rebounds for everyone, right?
And the other thing that I would just add to put a button on this question about short-term versus long-term and individual versus collective benefits is that, you know, if people are very opposed to government-mandated lockdowns, I completely empathize with that. But the alternative in the early days of the pandemic was not either lockdown or life continues as normal. It was either formal, short, harsh, formal lockdown that then yields, at least if you don't have the virus entering from outside, if you're actually a closed off community like many of the country East Asian countries and Australia and New Zealand were, that then yields a return to normality much quicker. Because the reality is that people in London and New York, you know, there's a de facto lockdown even if there's not a de jure lockdown. Nobody wants to go out and sit in a crowded cafe with their friends if there's a very good chance they're going to get really sick for 2 weeks as a result of doing so. So people just have to interminably stay at home by choice. But let's just move to expertise, because, you know, part of the whole problem in the podcast media verse is that, and this is particularly pronounced on social media, that who gets to be sort of considered an expert? Like, there are enough PhDs and there are enough people at Ivy League institutions who are dissenters from the consensus that you will always be able to find a very, very credible sounding person. I mean, you and I could name
five people
who keep appearing on, you know, on the Usual Suspects podcasts, delivering misinformation, wrongly interpreted studies. Well, yeah, vaccines are much worse than you think. Masks do nothing. There's a conspiracy between the CDC, the WHO, and China. Ivermectin works much better than people thought, but the drug companies are suppressing the data. And people will send me stuff on Twitter. They'll send me, you know, individual studies that they've been hunting around for because they believe that it's their responsibility as a rational person to seek out the information for themselves and come to their own conclusions and have conversations with people who might open their eyes to points of view that are not the dogmatic establishment point of view. And they think that I'm a naive representative of the blind sheeple for giving credence to what I would regard as being a consensus view. I try to go to people who represent the the mainstream view of the world's leading experts in something. I try not to find the one expert who bucks the trend. And this isn't just true for the pandemic. It's right. Attitude towards climate science and everything. Yeah, where are we?
Absolutely. This is very true of climate science. This is very true of many political reporting. You know, I think journalism, you know, obviously, there's sometimes you have to present both sides. Sometimes both sides of them can be a little dangerous when it comes to, you know, things like Holocaust denial. But generally, you know, there's so many studies, and not every study will agree, and many studies are poorly done. And if in the meta-analysis or systematic review, when we synthesize all the stuff together, you know, we have a saying, junk in, junk out, right? You have to have this filter, and this filter of what is a good study, well, it then becomes some people cherry pick only the studies to show what they want and present it to the world. And some studies only cherry pick that. But this is why, you know, there is consensus building, but that process is not something the lay public can sometimes do, right? It's a little bit technical. Like there's some study that says long COVID isn't real in kids. It was a junk case control study. You can't use that to assess prevalence, but a lay person would never know that. And I think there's a lot of cherry pickers out there who have a pre-existing political bias, and they cherry pick things that, you know, is favorable to them. And you see this in politics too, right? You cherry pick one certain narrative and for your political angle and political side to attack the other with. It's incredibly frustrating. And this is why usually in a normal setting, you know, we would have a really good review. Does this drug, is it effective against cancer? And normally this process takes years. We filter, collect all the data from all these years, do a systematic review, have a panel, debate this, and set a policy guideline, and that's how it's done. But in a COVID era, you can cherry pick a lot of things and run with it. You know, preprints are generally okay, but there's dangerous preprints too. And by the way, the ivermectin thing, God, ivermectin. There's been a lot of studies that have been published, but with retracted or either by the author or the journal has retracted or slapped a warning on it. But someone before the warning was put on, or even after, they did a meta-analysis of it, including the fraudulent or heavily biased study, but they don't retract it. So they don't report that the study was retracted, or that they don't report that this study included retracted studies. And to them, you know, naively, oh, ivermectin works. Yeah, but the ones that show the benefit were the really biased, flawed, / fraudulent ones that were retracted. But that never makes it its way to the lay audience, right? Mm.
You mentioned earlier, like people don't see the hospitalizations, you know, so people wander around thinking that it's
out of
worse.
Sight, out of mind.
Like, you know, on New Year's Eve, I was up in Vermont was talking to a nurse who's a sibling of a family member of mine, and she'd just come up from North Carolina, and she was just, I mean, exhausted, just so exhausted. And she was saying, like, I just wish, you know, we are absolutely full. We are absolutely exhausted. It's all unvaccinated people, and they're getting really crook, and people are dying. And like, this is the reality that we are seeing day after day after day. And it did make me think, like, I wish that the people who think this is sort of a conversational game, you know, is myocarditis 4.6 out of 100,000 or like 7.2? And like, what is this? And, you know, should I trust this study? Like, go to a hospital and talk to the nurses and talk to the ER doctors about what is happening during the Omicron wave, and then tell me that it's just a cold. Yeah. So anyway, you know, so in terms of the selection of what you're actually looking at, if ivermectin were useful, just go and talk to hospitals, like go and, you know, talk. I mean,
like you would see huge trends. Like
you would absolutely, it's ridiculous to imagine
out of this world.
And why would drug companies, like every single like hospital, you know, company that owns hospitals is intentionally allowing its patients to die because they're in cahoots with drug companies? By what mechanism are they getting these kickbacks from the drug companies? By what mechanism, you know, what evidence is there that they are willfully, depriving their patients of things that work? Anyway,
there's none. Actually, the U.S. would actually make more money if you're hospitalized longer. So that doesn't even make sense. There's actually a protocol that, you know, if you're 10 days post COVID infection, then you're post COVID, but you could still be in your ICU. But that's actually well documented as well. Look, I want people just realize at the end of the day, if you don't want to talk about, oh, did they die with COVID or from COVID, or just look at the excess deaths. Mm. Excess deaths is, in many countries that have low testing, excess deaths is the best metric. Because you can average the average deaths from 2015, 2019, and then compare it for 2020, 2021, you can easily see the excess deaths. US is about to pop over 1 million excess deaths since February 2020. It's going to pop over 1 million next week.
Yeah.
And the excess deaths don't lie.
It's such a good point. And this is another thing that I wish I had. I mean, actually, when I walked into the Joe Rogan show, what I came armed with was a bunch of graphs of excess deaths, but not because I knew that we were going to talk about it, but just because I knew that if, for example, Sweden came up as being the example of the country that we should have emulated, or, you know,
Sweden's questions, excess deaths was highest in over 100 years.
It was huge. And if you compare it to neighboring countries with similar demographics like Norway and Denmark, it was really big. But I mean, you know, if you look at just the total number of body bags and you superimpose those graphs, you know, from all causes, it's absolutely clear that the UK, the US and Sweden performed way, way, way worse than Australia, Denmark, South Korea, New Zealand, and so on. If you could talk to yourself, Eric, back in January of 2020, from the perspective of today, what would you say? Would you say things have gone better or worse than you had feared when you tweeted out that tweet thread?
I think it's gone worse. I thought that, you know, we would have like a one or two wave pandemic, and then, you know, it will be bad for one or two waves, and then it'll be over by the time we got vaccines, right? But then these things keep rolling and rolling. And but in certain ways, it's not surprising that it's so bad, because we knew the anti-vax movement was really strong. We knew that the libertarian, the anti-mask, anti-lockdown movement would be really strong, because just by pure politics of it in this day and age. I think the surprising thing is how many variants that this has got and reinfections are really high. It penetrates both vaccines and previous immunity. That is just completely crazy. But you know, I think it's also crazy that the CDC didn't read the tea leaves of all the data from around the world. They kind of like just relied on their own, and plus UK's or Israel's. If it didn't happen in the US, UK or Israel, it didn't happen. That kind of like narrow-mindedness is just, and some of the bad advisors that they had were very.
But just thinking about the virus itself, Eric, did we not somewhat dodge a bullet in its lethality? I mean, in January of 2020, it could have been the case that, you know, it's killing 10 or 20% of people.
Here's why.
1%.
MERS has a 30% more case fatality rate. Like, Ebola has like 50%. But once you are sick with Ebola, you are so sick, you would never go out to work. You would never go out to a party. Right? You would be like near death and you wouldn't be spreading it. And so a virus that's super lethal, it can't be too hot, can't be too cold. There's a Goldilocks amount of lethality. If it's completely strong, then it wouldn't be the pandemic virus that spreads over the world, because half of all infections are asymptomatic.
But that's what
makes the virus so successful.
Right, but doesn't that also depend on whether or not there's an incubation period before symptoms arise? I mean, what if you're walking around for 5 days infecting everybody and then the statistics you're
exactly, but this, we have asymptomatic transmission. We have 50% of all cases are asymptomatic. And so that even during an incubation period, before you have symptoms, you're already spreading the virus. That's what makes the coronavirus such a perfect weapon, a weapon storm.
Right, but I'm saying, wouldn't it be an even worse weapon if it was 10 times more lethal than it currently is, but you also still had that asymptomatic characteristic?
Yeah, it could be worse. If your question is, can it be worse? Yes, the virus can be worse in many ways. And I think, God, this we have dodged bullets in certain ways, but you know, the virus is not finished. We have a second Omicron variant that is even potentially has also reinfection as well, and potentially faster. That, you know, again, ballooning the denominator will always kill more people. Between two viruses, it's more lethal and less contagious versus more contagious and less lethal. it's always the more contagious, less lethal virus that will kill more people. It's right. just the future nature of it, because what drives the, up the numbers in body bags is the number of cases. Again, you know, just like business by volume, you make more money by driving up the volume and making small percentages on the high volume. You know, in this case, you have high number of deaths because you're driving up the volume of these transmissions. That is what is so, so dangerous. And so, yes, we kind of dodged a bullet, but I guess in many ways, a more contagious, more immunity penetrating virus is ultimately way more dangerous. And that's actually why, you know, I've been running a trial for the past year in Mexico, in rural Mexico, on not a vaccine or a drug, but a vitamin D trial, a zinc, vitamin C, and B vitamin trial, and an omega-3 trial. There's no profit in it whatsoever, but these vitamins, they're pennies a day. I think it could actually help people's immune system. And this is why I don't talk about it on any of my Twitter, because we're waiting for the trial to finish. But I think we need... you know, we need to basically increase the world's baseline immunity as much as we can. And this is why malnutrition is really key, because the number one killer in the world is infectious disease in sub-Saharan Africa, in India, is actually malnutrition. Malnutrition contributes to immunocompromised status that contributes to childhood mortality. That's the main driver of childhood mortality. Even though it's infectious diseases, it's actually the malnutrition that contributes to the various malnutrition related diseases. And I think we need to think about beyond just the immediate virus per se. We need to think about how to prevent more infections and think out of the box. And again, this is not vaccine only. What the mistake of a lot of the policymakers was relying on vaccine only or lockdown only or testing only. You need to do all of them or most of them, plus other mitigations, especially ventilation, air disinfection. And I personally think nutrition is also really key in boosting people's immunity. But, yeah, but there's no profit. There's vaccine trials, vaccines. There's pharma has the money to run them. Pharma has the money to run these monoclonal antibody trials, Paxlovid drug trials, remdesivir trials. But there's no money in vitamins. And so I think this is why I'm really hopeful that we get really good results, and we're going to get results in the coming months.
Yeah, I mean, now you're sort of sounding a little bit like the alternative media podcasters and so on, by saying like
which is fine.
I mean, I'm not using it as a slur. I like a lot of these guys, and I think they make a lot of good points when they do.
Evidence to show that they work for some of them before.
Well, let me just clarify what I'm saying so I'm not misunderstood. Like people should be fit and their immune systems should be strong, and they should not be obese if they can avoid it. Like things like that. There's no money in saying that. There's no money in doing that, really. But if, as you say, we're going to have to continue throwing the kitchen sink at this problem for some time, then I would grant to all of the people who are outside the media mainstream the single principle that we should be able to agree on, which is, let's also give a sort of what I might think of as being a light touch rating to each strategy. So, always use the minimum possible dose to achieve the thing. You know, if the alternative is either locking people up in a quarantine facility for 2 weeks or installing HEPA filters on public transport, go for the HEPA filters. If the alternative is forcing everybody to wear masks that don't work everywhere, or requiring people to have, free N95 masks, which they wear only in circumstances which are high risk, then do the latter. Like, if we're going to have to deal with this for a long time, then let's be smart about the things that we require people to do and require them not to do. So, vaccination is easily the best because it's super easy, super safe, and super effective. Yeah. And then, as you say, like things like washing hands and whatever else we can do. I just want to allow the dissidents space to be able to say, let's not do everything and turn it all up to 11 forever.
Right. I'm not for lockdowns, and I want to repeat that. But I think if you don't want lockdowns, you better do a lot of other things to ward off, right? Lockdown should only be the last resort. And I think you need to, and it's not just either or. You probably need like 4 or 5 out of the 6-7 strategies. And again, we need compliance and solidarity of doing them together and doing them quick, because we're always sandbagging right now whenever the flood's already here. Sandbagging when the flood's already here doesn't protect a lot of the people who are already underwater. That's literally what we're always doing. It's always too little, too late. And then there's lots of finger pointing and, you know, crazy accusation and blame games and political theater that then arouses. And I think, and, you know, people just need to prepare better.
Since you were the soothsayer, the fortune teller at the beginning of the pandemic, I'll ask you to prognosticate. You've just articulated what things should look like if you are emperor of the world, but let's talk about what things will look like. In fact, why did you delete the Twitter thread originally back then? Were you copping so much flack for being a Chicken Little that you felt you needed to get rid of it?
Because I was googling for it. I thought that people already heard it, and people. You know, I also got a lot of professional disagreements. You know,
were there things that you got wrong that you're embarrassed about now?
There was like one comment I quickly deleted within an hour, but the main top post, the Holy Mother of God thing, that one was the thing that eventually deleted like weeks later. But that was only because I got a lot of professional flack. But by then, it didn't really matter.
Can you articulate what the substance of that was?
Yeah, I misread one paper. I was tweeting this at like, you know, past midnight, 1 a.m.
So yeah, I've been there.
So anyways, I deleted it within hours of me discovering it. But I think, you know, prognosticating, predicting this pandemic is really hard. Because the whole thing with variants makes it unpredictable, right? Like no one could have predicted there will be another Omicron 2.0, like literally 1 month after the first Omicron hit. People always thought, oh, give us at least 3 or 4 months before the next big one comes, at least. But I think we need like multi-layer strategies. We need really, really high seawall of all these things together. And, you know, is it going to be endemic? Yeah, probably. But the thing that people are not capturing is there can be a high endemic, really, really dangerous repeating cycles endemic of all this crazy, crazy high number of hospitalization surges that we don't want. Or there could be a low background level pandemic, endemic. And I think the low background level is something what we want to aim for, even if we cannot eliminate all of it. And I think this is where you have to have all these strategies. I think this is a test of our humanity. Like, can we get together and do we have the willpower to build a Manhattan Project, not just for vaccines or a nuclear bomb, but build a Manhattan Project for actually supporting all of these modalities, HEPA filters, indoor air, all of these together for a short period of time so we can get over this. And I think that is the ultimate test of this. And if we don't pass, we're going to be living with a very, very dangerous level of COVID for a long time. And I think this is where we're at a fork in the road. I can't predict that things will be hunky-dory, fabulously normal again in the near future, given all the current political wrangling and, you know, individualistic, you know, selfishness that I'm seeing around the world. I think we're going to be in COVID for a little bit while longer. And there's that makes me really, really sad. It really pains me. But this is why I really want your audience, Rogan's audience, and many of these other people to say, hey, you know, let's really come together. You know, us fighting and bickering is only going to spread COVID longer because we're allowing this loosey-goosey, haphazard system in which only half the people comply. Again, it's the transmission that's going to pile up more bodies ultimately and cause more variants. It's really getting the cases down to a low, low level and then protecting that low amount of level. And that will require some short-term pain for long-term gain. You know, where's our mutual sacrifice for that? Mm. And, you know, this is, again, for long-term earnings, not just quarterly juicing the quarterly earnings. And I think people really need to see that and see that on the other side is more freedom, not less freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. That's key. On that optimistic note, with a tinge of sadness, but somewhat optimistic note, Eric, thank you so much for all your time and all your work. Yeah. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
Uncomfortable Conversations is produced by Stefan Postuma. Follow me, Josh Sepps, on Twitter and Instagram for all the latest. May your day be fruitful, your mind humble, your enemies generous, and your conversations perfectly, sparklingly, delectably uncomfortable.